515, contact New York Center 125.9, squawk 7500.
New York Center 125.9, Air France 315, squawking 7500, flying Washington to Paris.
Air France 315, radar contact 310 miles southeast of Nantucket. Maintain flight level 350.
Maintaining flight level 350, New York Center.
Air France 315, report passing 250 miles southeast of Nantucket.
Will do, Air France 315.
Copy that, Air France 315.
My name is Arthur Benning. The drive from J. Edgar to Dulles can be a test of patience on the best of days, and today the city seemed to conspire against me. I sat there, ensnared in a labyrinth of idling vehicles, the rhythmic thump of my wipers a dull metronome against the drizzle-spattered windshield. Route 66 was never a happy place to find yourself this time of day, but today felt especially hopeless. The overcast sky hung low, a gray blanket that seemed to smother the color from the world, turning the late autumn leaves into nothing more than soggy, discarded inconveniences. I tapped my fingers on the steering wheel, a nervous habit I'd picked up in the Gulf. It was days like this that made me question my decision to move back to the East Coast, to a city that could suffocate you with its congestion and its politics. I'd been given the barest of briefings. A person of interest detained by the customs officers at Dulles. The phrase was vague, a catch-all that could mean anything from a suspected spy to an overzealous tourist with the wrong paperwork. The Bureau seemed to be less and less obliged to give us any information about what we were walking into. I'd been down this road before, out to the airport on a wild goose chase, like the time a nervous customs officer had flagged down a university professor for carrying nothing more threatening than a suitcase full of antique watches, somehow mistaken as explosives. That day had been a wash, the kind that left you questioning the instincts that had brought you to the job in the first place. I was convinced that the perpetual construction of Route 66 was the culprit of my delay, but up ahead, the pulsing strobe of emergency lights cut through the drear, near what looked to be some sort of multi-car accident. The accident seemed serious, but the driver's decision to inspect their vehicles in the left lane instead of pulling over would have a ripple effect for miles. I reached for the console where my own siren switch lay dormant. The temptation to flip it and cut along the side of the freeway became stronger the longer we stood still. As I weighed my options, the monotony of traffic updates on the radio was broken by the familiar jingle that preempted the sports segment. The radio host, his voice cutting in and out slightly, declared with gusto how the Redskins trounced the Bears at home this weekend. I shook my head slightly, trying to sync the announcer's words with the reality I knew. The Redskins game wasn't supposed to be until Halloween, a couple of days away still. I should know. I had the tickets in my wallet, a pair of prized seats I had won in a charity auction. Not to mention, it was only a few days ago I had watched Washington suffer a bitter loss to Dallas from my living room. I turned up the radio as if the volume could somehow correct the anomaly. The announcer's voice filled the car. McNown threw three interceptions before being benched, and even the Bears' backup quarterback decided to join the party, tossing another one for good measure. Stephen Davis ran for a season-high 143 yards as the Skins improved to 5-2. A knot of confusion tightened in my gut. The details were too precise, too vivid to be a mere mistake. Yet it was impossible. I glanced at the date on my dashboard clock. October 27th, 1999, confirming what I already knew. The voice on the radio was like a splinter in my mind, irritatingly persistent and utterly out of place. I reached for my wallet with a sense of urgency I couldn't quite justify. My fingers fumbled with the worn leather, searching for the tickets that would confirm the date. Before I could extract them, I flinched as an ambulance with its lights flashing and engine roaring tore past me in the breakdown lane. There was a sharp crack as my right side mirror was clipped by the passing vehicle. I craned my neck and cursed when I saw my right side mirror laying in 1,000 pieces along the side of the highway. The sudden jolt of violence against my vehicle felt like divine motivation. Enough was enough. I flicked on my own lights, the siren wailing to life, and without a second thought, I steered into the breakdown lane, leaving the stagnant sea of traffic behind.
New York Center, Air France 315. We're observing some unexpected cloud formation ahead. Can we get a weather update?
Air France 315, Roger. Stand by for weather check.
Standing by New York Center.
Air France 315 weather report shows clear skies along your route. No significant weather systems detected. Visibility unlimited.
Copy that. We're definitely seeing some dark cloud formations about 50 miles ahead. We ran into something like this yesterday. Are you sure there's nothing on radar?
Air France 315, we've double-checked our systems. Still showing clear skies and no weather formations in your vicinity or projected path.
Understood. We'll continue to monitor and report any changes.
Roger that, Air France 315. Keep us informed of any developments.
I stepped out of the confines of my government-issued sedan, parked haphazardly in the employee lot. The wind grabbed at my suit, as if it was trying to delay my entry. The main terminal of Dulles hummed with activity. It was a symphony of white noise punctuated by the intermittent squawk of intercom announcements and the clatter of rolling suitcases. The air held the faint, ubiquitous scent of all airports, which was that of overbrewed coffee. I navigated through the throngs of people as I made my way to the security desk near the entrance. I presented my badge to the guard, a woman with sharp eyes that flicked between it to my face and back again. She nodded and disappeared into the back room. As I pocketed my badge, a man emerged from the same doorway behind the guard desk. He was broad-shouldered, his uniform straining slightly against his girth. He introduced himself as Officer Carter. He extended a firm handshake, and with a nod, he led me past the security checkpoint. We ventured deeper into the security area of the airport, Carter's wide gate taking long strides through the sterile corridors. He explained, with an air of slight embarrassment, how one of his fresh-faced officers had flagged an arrival passenger earlier in the day. The young officer had found something off during the routine passport check. Carter halted abruptly, his features pinched with a bizarre mix of confusion and sheepishness. I could tell he wasn't thrilled with whatever he was dealing with. "Agent Benning," he began, his hesitation evident in the pause that followed. "We stopped a gentleman. Name's Harlan Duval. He's got a passport. Looks as official as they come." He paused again, this time scrubbing a hand over his face as though trying to wipe away the absurdity of what he was about to say. "Thing is, it's stamped from a place called the Republic of Torrid. Ever heard of it?" I shook my head. My mind was already sifting through the archives of geopolitical knowledge I'd accumulated during my years at the Bureau, and as a political science student, trying to recall if I should know this place. Carter's eyes met mine. "That's just it. No one has. It's because it doesn't exist." I allowed myself a wry smile. The idea of an undiscovered country was almost charming in its impossibility, but Carter's face remained stern. "Harlan Duval," he repeated, his voice a low rumble. He's convincing. "Been in the secondary inspection room for more than a few hours now. He speaks with this odd accent. Can't place it." I raised an eyebrow at that. "And he's convinced he's from... Torrid?" Carter nodded. "The Republic of Torrid," he confirmed. His jowls moved heavily with the motion. "More than that, he's got plane tickets, currency, documents, all pointing to this place. I don't know how, but no one's ever heard of it." My mind jumped back into law enforcement mode now that I realized that this was more than a joke. I quickly asked, "How many people have spoken to him, and was he traveling alone?" Carter's eyebrows knitted together. "Just me and the agent who initially flagged him," he said firmly. "He was traveling by himself. Claims he is here for work." Carter looked at me, his eyes a blend of concern and frustration. I don't know how long we are able to hold him. We don't have any precedent here. But something about him just doesn't sit right with me. Carter and I resumed our trek through the corridors, the hum of the airport receding as we moved further into the secure area. Which flight was he on? I asked, my tone suggesting that it was something that Carter should have led with. Carter glanced at me but responded while looking ahead. He claimed he was on the flight from France, his voice echoing slightly off the linoleum floors. We checked, and there was a flight that came in from Paris around that time. We're still scrubbing what footage we have around the terminal. I barely suppressed the smirk that tugged at the corners of my mouth as we walked. The absurdity of it was almost comical. We stepped through the penultimate door before the secondary inspection room.
New York Center, Air France 315. We're experiencing some unusual radio interference. Do you copy?
Air France 315, New York Center, we read. Can you describe the nature of the interference?
We're getting intermittent static and some cross chatter. We heard another pilot using our call sign, 315.
Air France 315, please repeat. You heard another aircraft identify as Air France 315. We're not showing any other traffic on your frequency.
That's affirmative, New York. Same call sign, it's not us.
Copy Air France 315. No unauthorized transmissions on our end. Could be an equipment issue.
Negative, New York. All systems check out. We'll continue to monitor.
Roger that, Air France 315.
Carter stopped abruptly just before the door to the interrogation room with his hand resting on the metal handle. He looked over towards me but didn't meet my eyes. Look, he started, his voice a low rumble. We haven't really confronted him yet about, you know, where he claims he is from. We only told him that he was flagged and asked him about his passport. His story hasn't wavered, and frankly, we just didn't know what we were supposed to do in this situation. Carter handed me the passport with a look of relief to no longer be in possession of it. I took it, my fingers brushing against the embossed emblem on the cover, a shield adorned with mountains and stars surrounded by the words République de Tarid. The passport felt weighty in my hand, official. It felt and looked as real as any passport I'd ever held. I flipped it open and there he was, Harlan Duval staring back at me with an eerily blank expression. I closed the passport with a soft snap and looked up at Carter and met his gaze with a firm nod. He pushed open the door to the interrogation room, and we stepped inside. The room was a cramped box, 10 by 10 at most. Plain, off-white walls closed in around me with a polished chrome table that dominated the space. Three metal chairs sat stoically around it, bolted to the floor, one of which was occupied by Harlan Duval. His eyes fixed on me with an unsettling intensity. He studied me, as if he were trying to peel back the layers to see what lay beneath my skin. It wasn't until Carter closed the door behind us that he spoke. There has been some sort of mistake. Why am I being held here? He said, his accent a strange tapestry of sounds that didn't belong together. Carter had been right. It was linguistically chameleon, hinting at French, Italian, and Spanish influences, yet not quite landing on anyone. It was this accent that made his otherwise ordinary words seem alien. I took a seat across from him and the metal chair creaked under my weight. His face was expressionless, but there was something about it that didn't sit right. Carter shifted uncomfortably behind me, his chair pushed back to the wall. "I'm Special Agent Arthur Benning," I said as I sat down, placing Harlan's passport on the table between us. My fingers tapped against the cover, and this, I gestured over my shoulder to Carter without breaking eye contact with Harlan, is Officer Carter, though I understand you've already met. Harlan remained completely still. His expressionless gaze never wavered from mine. "Let's start with the basics," I said, leaning back in my chair, trying to appear relaxed. "Where are you coming from, Mr. Duval?" "Paris," he replied without hesitation. And before that? I asked, keeping my tone casual. Harlan's answer was immediate. Tarred. I heard Officer Carter adjust himself in his seat again behind me. I let my eyes roam over Harlan's face, looking for a twitch, a flicker of the eyes, anything that might betray a lie or hint that this was some sort of joke. I noticed the blandness of his face, none of his features particularly standing out. His expression remained placid. The silence stretched out between us, punctuated only by the hum of the fluorescent lights overhead. Harlan didn't rush to fill it, nor did he seem discomforted by it. He simply sat there, waiting. I cleared my throat. Okay, and where exactly is Tored? Duval's expression shifted subtly while his eyes narrowed almost imperceptibly. He looked as if he were disappointed by my ignorance. He spoke with the patience one might reserve for a child. Tored lies between Spain and France in the heart of the Pyrenees Mountains. The confidence in his voice caught me out a bit, causing my eyebrows to rise slightly. I shot a glance back at Carter with a look of, "Wow, you weren't kidding." The only signs of movement from Harlan were from his eyes, which darted around the room. "What is the problem, Agent?" I ignored his question for the moment. "Mr. Duval, tell me something about your home country," I said, watching his reaction closely. Harlan took a deep breath through his nose and began to paint a vivid picture of Tared. His eyes switched between Carter and I as he spoke of his country, which he claimed was home to over 15 million people. He told us of Montvieux, the capital, which he described as nestled in a verdant valley. He spoke of the conquest of Pyrenea, a historical event that shaped the nation's independence. He detailed the War of the Pyrenees with a soldier's precision, where he recounted tales of diplomacy and valor, as if he had lived through them himself. Harlan's voice took on a proud tone as he delved into the modern era and described how Tord had evolved into a thriving parliamentary democracy. The way he spoke of Tord felt like performance, but a convincing one at that. For a moment, I found myself wanting to believe him. But I had to remind myself there was no country between Spain and France. There was no Montvieux. There was no Tored. "And what brought you to the United States today?" I replied quickly, hoping to catch him off guard. "I'm here on business," Harlan said, his hands remained under the table. "I represent a company based in Tored that specializes in renewable energy. We have potential clients interested in our technology here in America." His tone was matter of fact, devoid of any hint of deceit. "And how long do you plan to stay in the United States?" I asked, looking for holes in the details of his supposed itinerary. "A week, perhaps two," Harlan replied smoothly. "It depends on how the discussions progress. Tord has made significant advancements in solar and hydroelectric power. There's much interest in our innovations." I scratched at the beard on my jaw, feeling a bit annoyed at how prepared this all seemed. "Excuse us for a moment, Mr. Duval," I said as I stood up, my metal chair scraping against the floor. Harlan's eyes flickered with something that might have been concern or contempt, but he did not protest. Carter followed me out of the room. As I stood there in the hallway, watching Carter close the door behind us, my mind raced with the information Harlan had provided. I caught Carter's eye, and for a moment we shared a silent conversation. I glanced away, my gaze drifting towards one of the office rooms. There was a man inside, his eyes briefly meeting mine before he returned to his paperwork. Without a word to Carter, I strode into the office. The room was cluttered with desks in varying states of use. I found what I was looking for hanging on the back wall, a laminated map of the world. Without second thought, I ripped it down. I re-entered the hallway where Carter remained leaning against the wall with a look of quiet anticipation as he saw the map in my hand. I didn't need to say anything. I gave him a nod, and we entered the room once more. I sat back down across from Harlan and spread the map out on the table between us. I gave him an artificial smile with a nod and asked, "Can you point out Tored on this map, Mr. Duval?" His eyes met mine, a flicker of hesitation crossing his otherwise impassive face. For a moment, I thought he might refuse. But then he pulled his hands out from beneath the table for the first time and reached out to spin the map around to face him. The skin on his hands appeared to be unhealthy and to be peeling in several places. Harlan's hand hovered over the table, poised to point out his supposed homeland. He leaned closer to inspect the map. Only then did I notice that I had not seen this man blink once. I watched as the confidence he'd exuded earlier seemed to wane. He traced the outline of the landmass with his finger, moving back and forth between France and Spain. "What is this?" Harlan finally asked while looking up at me. His voice was laced with an edge of frustration. His finger tapped on the map between France and Spain. I picked up the map, holding it out for Carter to see. "It's the same map we all grew up with, isn't it?" Carter nodded silently. Suddenly, Harlan's demeanor shifted. His composure cracked, and a spark of anger flared in his eyes. "This map is wrong," he insisted, his finger still pointing to the area between France and Spain. "Do you truly mean to say that my country does not exist? Is this some sort of political agenda?" His voice echoed off the walls. I remained silent, watching him with a steady gaze. His conviction was unsettling. I flipped the map over with deliberate slowness, breaking the tension that had settled in the room. "We'll have to agree to disagree on that one, Mr. Duval, because as far as I know, there is no Torrid." Harlan leaned back in his chair, returning to his original position while his eyes burned with indignation. I stood up slowly. "Mr. Duval," I said, my voice carrying a weight of authority, "when I return, I want to hear the truth. You understand the seriousness of forging a passport and attempting illegal entry into this country?" His face held defiant, but he didn't speak. I exchanged a glance with Carter, who looked equally unnerved by Harlan's reaction. We left the room, the heavy door clicking shut behind us. "I want to speak with one of the flight attendants from the French flight," I said with a tone that left no room for argument. "Get me someone who can confirm his presence, or lack thereof, on that plane." Carter nodded, recognizing the gravity in my voice. He quickly pulled out his radio to relay the request.
New York Center, Air France 315, we need to report a near miss.
Air France 315, go ahead. What's your situation?
We just had an extremely close pass with another aircraft. It came out of nowhere.
315, can you provide details, type, direction, position?
The aircraft looked very old, like something from the 1940s or 50s, a propeller plane. There's no way that thing should be able to get up to this altitude. East, west, east, west.
315, confirm, an antique aircraft?
Affirmative, New York. My co-pilot saw it too.
Stand by, 315, checking radar.
Standing by.
315, radar shows no traffic within 100 miles. Are you certain?
Affirmative, New York. It disappeared as quickly as it appeared.
Understood, 315. We'll log the incident, continue to monitor, and report any further sightings.
We chose a table near the back, which wobbled slightly on the tiled floor in a small coffee shop, tucked away near one of the gates. I took a seat facing the entrance, and Carter sat beside me, his bulk making the chair creak under his weight. A young woman, Colette Serrano, joined us moments later. Her flight attendant uniform was immaculate, the Air France logo embroidered neatly on her blazer. Her dark hair was pinned back, though a few rebellious curls framed her face. As she settled into her seat, I offered Colette a small appreciative smile. "Thank you for meeting with us on such short notice, Ms. Serrano." My voice low and even, trying to put her at ease. I let her sip her tea for a moment before asking, "Can you confirm for me that you were on Air France Flight 314 from Paris to Washington, D.C.?" Colette nodded, a flicker of unease crossing her face at the formality of my question. "Yes, I was on Flight 314. We departed at approximately 6 p.m. French time," she confirmed. Her voice was steady despite a nervous flicker in her hazel eyes. Her gaze darted between Carter and I, as if seeking assurance that she had given the correct information. I leaned forward slightly, the chair giving beneath me. Was there anything different or strange about the flight, perhaps with the boarding procedures? I asked, with a tone suggesting casual curiosity rather than pressing urgency. Colette's brow narrowed and her eyes seemed to search internally with the effort of recollection. For a moment, she seemed to draw a blank, her lips parting silently. Then, as if a switch had been flipped, her expression changed. Yes, there was something, she said, her accent thickening with the rush of memory. We were serving drinks, the plane. It was as if we entered a pocket of night. Complete darkness in the cabin for a few moments. It was very strange, but it passed quickly. The pilot told us it was nothing dangerous. I gave Colette an assuring smile, but sighed internally, recognizing that this line of questioning was not going to be fruitful. For a short while longer, I attempted to extract any specifics regarding the boarding procedures that might have permitted an individual to not be subjected to the airport's security measures while boarding the aircraft. After a few non-helpful answers, I then nodded to Carter, a cue for him to produce the passport. He fished it out of his pocket and flipped it open to Harlan's picture, holding it out for Colette to see. "Do you remember seeing this man on your flight, Ms. Serrano?" Carter asked. She took the passport, her fingers delicately tracing the edges before she brought it closer to examine the photograph. Her eyes narrowed slightly, and then she looked up at us, a note of certainty in her voice. "Yes, I remember him," she said, handing the passport back to Carter. He was seated towards the back. There were a few empty rows around him. She paused as she tried to piece the memory together. "It's weird, but I don't think I noticed him until a couple of hours into the flight. We were busy up front. But with the flight not being full, passengers sometimes move around to find more comfortable spots." I paused and waited for a small family to pass the table before continuing. "Think carefully, Colette," I said, turning my attention back to her. "Can you recall if you saw this gentleman as passengers were boarding? Is it possible he boarded the aircraft in a manner that was different from the other passengers?" Her face scrunched in concentration but shook her head slowly, her eyes meeting mine with certainty. "No, I did not see him until well after we had taken off. I am sure of it." We exchanged a few more words, but any further conversation seemed like it would be fruitless. Expressing gratitude for her assistance, I stood, which Carter and Colette followed in suit. As we prepared to part ways, I turned back to Colette one more time. "One more thing, Ms. Serrano, have you ever heard of a place called Torrid?" Colette shook her head hesitantly, as if she was unsure of the correct answer. We thanked her once more and watched her slip into the crowd of travelers. "I need to call this in," I said sternly to Carter. "Meet me at the secondary inspection room in 20 minutes.
New York Center, Air France 315. We've entered some kind of weather cell. Visibility is zero. We're surrounded by total darkness.
Air France 315, confirm your position. We're not showing any weather in your area.
Negative. New York instruments are giving conflicting readings. We're in pitch black out here.
Roger, 315. Any turbulence or other effects?
Negative. We're riding calm, but it's complete darkness. We cannot climb or descend.
Copy, no anomalies on radar. I need you down to 10,000 feet.
Negative, New York. I repeat, we are unable to change altitude. I've lost pitch control.
315, clarify. What do you see? Air France 315, report 315.
I met Carter outside the secondary inspection room where we stood in the harsh artificial light. "We need a new angle," I said, something to shake him up. Carter nodded, but I didn't wait for him to respond. "Something subtle. I want to play into his delusion, see if we can catch him off guard." Carter's eyes widened slightly, but he didn't object. Without another word, I turned and pushed open the door. I stepped into the cramped, sterile room where Harlan Duval sat, appearing to have regained that unsettling confidence again. "Mr. Duval," I began, setting my briefcase on the table with a clack. "I've spoken with a flight attendant who confirmed your presence on the flight from Paris. I watched him closely, looking for any flicker of unease. However, she doesn't recall you boarding." Duval's expression didn't falter. "Perhaps she was preoccupied," he suggested smoothly. I paused, leaning back in my chair, letting the silence hang between us. "Perhaps," I echoed, my gaze steady on his. "But it's a curious thing, isn't it?" His eyes met mine, and for a moment, there was a flicker of something I could almost call uncertainty. He quickly masked it with a polite smile. "I must insist that I be allowed to call my family. They can verify my story." I couldn't help but chuckle at that. "And why should I believe that your family won't just be playing along with your little tale?" I asked, leaning forward slightly to emphasize my skepticism. He looked at me steadily, but his eyes gave away nothing. "I assure you, they have nothing to gain by lying." I held his gaze for a moment longer before breaking away to retrieve a notepad and pen from my briefcase. "Very well," I said, placing the items on the table with deliberate care. "I'll take their names down and we'll see about verifying your claim." Duval watched me intently as I jotted down the names as he recited them. "Carmen, Isabel, and Sophia." The scrape of Carter's chair startled me and I looked up to see him on his feet, face flushed with anger. "Who are you?" he demanded, glaring at Harlan. Confused, I glanced between them. Harlan's face remained impassive, almost expectant. Carter's fists clenched at his sides. Those are the names of my wife and daughters," he spat out. I turned back to Harlan. My expression was a mix of disappointment and frustration. Before I could speak, Carter's voice boomed through the room again. "Who are you?" he demanded once more, his face still filled with anger. Harlan remained silent. "Carter, step out," I said, not looking at him. My tone left no room for argument. But Carter didn't move. His eyes remained fixed on Harlan, fists clenched at his sides. Annoyed, I stood up and guided him out into the hallway. Once outside, I faced Carter, who was still seething. "You need to calm down if you want to go back in there," I said, trying to reason with him. Carter's eyes darted past me toward the door. "If he even mentions something about my family, I swear." "Get a grip," I cut him off, my patience wearing thin. "Either you collect yourself, or you're not going back in. Your choice." I watched Carter's jaw clench and unclench as he struggled to regain composure. His eyes still burned with anger, but he gave a curt nod, signaling his agreement to my ultimatum. I re-entered the room with Carter close behind. As I settled into my chair, I scratched my beard while my mind raced to find a new approach. "Mr. Duval," I began again, leaning forward slightly, "I want to be clear about something. I could arrest you right now for attempting to illegally enter this country." I paused, letting the weight of my words sink in. "But that's not what I want to do." "So here's where we stand," I continued, my voice low and measured. "Either you give me something real to work with, or you drop this act, because right now, you're not doing yourself any favors." There was a brief silence until Carter's radio suddenly crackled to life, breaking the stillness. A tinny voice requested his presence elsewhere. "I'll be right back," Carter muttered, his tone clipped. He cast one last glare at Harlan before exiting the room, the door closing with a soft click behind him. Once Carter was gone, I rubbed my eyes and began again. "Look, I've been in counterintelligence for years. I've studied maps, geopolitics, and international relations extensively. How do you think it's possible that neither I nor any of my colleagues have ever heard of a major European country with a population of over 15 million people, as you claim?" "Agent Benning," he replied, his strange accent giving his words an unsettling tone. "As someone who has also studied history, I find it equally perplexing that you seem unaware of my homeland. Tord has existed for many centuries, playing a significant role in European history. Perhaps there's been some misunderstanding in your education or intelligence gathering. I couldn't help but feel amused by his persistence. Mr. Duval, I can assure you there's been no mistake. I glanced up at the wall clock that seemed to no longer be working. The minute and hour hand had not moved since he had first arrived, but the second hand spun far too quickly. Let's try a different approach, I mused. Why don't we see what we can agree on? That might help us figure out where our understandings diverge. If he was going to fabricate an entire country, there was bound to be inconsistencies. The French Revolution, I stated plainly. Harlan nodded. The storming of the Bastille. Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were executed. The Reign of Terror followed, led by Robespierre. Napoleon rose to power in its aftermath. His response was concise and factual. I continued, the Industrial Revolution. Harlan replied, unfazed. It was the transition from hand production to machines. Steam power and the factory system emerged. Child labor became prevalent. Cities grew rapidly as people moved from rural areas for work. I nodded, conceding his knowledge of major historical events so far as I knew them. Then, I decided to push further. World War I. World War I? Harlan repeated in a way that took the form of a question. I nodded, giving him an expectant look. Harlan's face remained impassive, but there was a flicker of confusion in his eyes. I'm not familiar with that term. Are you referring to the War of 1914? We call that the Great War. I leaned back in my chair, studying him. Well, you'd be correct up until 1942, when World War II started. At this, Harlan's expression shifted. He looked at me with a mix of suspicion and genuine contempt. World War II? I'm afraid I don't know what you're referring to. I am not aware of any other global conflict beyond the Great War. I shook my head. Either this man was an incredibly skilled actor, or he was truly delusional. Well, Mr. Duval, what is it that you think happened during the Great War then? I asked, leaning forward slightly. For a brief, unsettling moment as Harlan prepared to answer, his eyes seemed to look in completely different directions, as if focusing on two separate points in space. It was so quick I almost convinced myself I had imagined it. As Harlan began, the account he gave of the Great War was eerily familiar, yet still disturbingly inaccurate. He spoke of trench warfare, the use of poison gas, and the fall of empires, all recognizable elements. But then he described the events that never happened. The assassination of Kaiser Wilhelm II by a lone anarchist, leading to Germany's immediate withdrawal from the war, a devastating plague, far deadlier than the Spanish flu, that wiped out half of Europe's population, and the unprecedented rise of a unified Nordic Empire after a coup in Sweden consolidated all Scandinavian countries under one rule. Harlan's voice remained steady as he spoke of a world where the Ottoman Empire dissolved into dozens of warring city-states, where the Russian Revolution never birthed the Soviet Union, but instead led to a balkanization of the country into smaller, infighting regions. I sat there stunned into silence by Harlan's response. His version of history was so wildly different from reality, yet he recounted it with such conviction. It was as if he truly believed every word. Mr. Duval, I finally managed, shaking my head in disbelief. That would make for one hell of a fiction book. I'd buy it. Harlan's face remained impassive, not a hint of amusement crossing his features. His eyes, still unnervingly focused, bore into mine with an intensity that made me shift uncomfortably in my seat. I assure you, Agent Benning, he said, his voice steady and serious, this is not fiction. Right, I said as I stood up. Excuse me for a moment, Mr. Duval. I stepped out into the hallway and took a moment to myself. This whole situation was getting more bizarre by the minute. I made my way to the security center, scanning the room until I spotted a desk with a bored-looking man behind it. Hey, I asked, flashing my badge. I'm looking for Officer Carter. Seen him? The man looked up, his eyes narrowing as he shuffled through some papers on his desk. After a moment, he shook his head. "Officer Carter, he didn't come in today." I felt my jaw clench. "What do you mean he didn't come in? He was just here with me." The man shrugged, looking uncomfortable. "Sorry, sir. According to the log, he's not on duty." For a moment, I considered tearing into the guy, but I caught myself, realizing it wouldn't do any good. With a frustrated sigh, I turned and walked away. I re-entered the room where Harlan sat motionless, his gaze fixed on some invisible point in the distance. I remained standing, leaning against the wall, and let out a heavy sigh. "Mr. Duval, I'll be frank. I don't know what to do with you." I let the words hang a moment. "We'll have a decision by morning, but it's not mine to make." Harlan didn't react. "In the meantime," I continued, "the airport will provide a hotel room for you. It'll be guarded, and you won't be permitted to leave. I hope you understand." Still, Harlan remained silent, staring straight ahead. "We'll sort this out tomorrow, one way or another." After a moment that felt like an eternity, Harlan slowly raised his head. His eyes met mine, and in a monotone voice he said, "That would be a mistake." Undeterred by his vague threat, I shrugged, maintaining an air of indifference. "It's out of my hands, Mr. Duval. I'll see you tomorrow, regardless." Without waiting for a response, I turned and left.
New York Center, Air France 315. We have a situation on board. We're missing several passengers.
Air France 315, confirm you're reporting missing passengers.
Affirmative, several passengers are unaccounted for. They're just gone. We came out of that weather cell and we're down five passengers.
315, any signs of a breach in the cabin or cargo hold?
Negative, all doors are secure, no depressurization, there's no sign of a breach. They're just not here.
Understood, 315. When was the last confirmed passenger count?
Before takeoff, standard procedure, we had 78 souls on board. We are down to 73.
315, I need you to conduct a thorough search of the aircraft.
Affirmative, we've already searched everywhere. Bathrooms, galley, cargo hold. They're not on board.
Roger, 315, stand by while we consult with security.
Standing by. Please expedite. Some of the passengers are becoming anxious. Crew is telling me some of them are refusing to sit next to some male on board.
Copy, 315, sit tight. We are going to reroute you. Stand by.
I arrived at the security center early the next morning, my mind still churning over the bizarre events of the previous day. I paced the room, checking my watch every few minutes as I waited for airport security to bring Harlan from his hotel room. As time dragged on, my patience wore thin. I approached the same security desk from the prior day, hoping to get some answers. A different man sat behind it, his eyes glued to a huge set of files on his desk. "Excuse me," I said, tapping the counter. "I'm looking for Officer Carter. Have you seen him?" The man looked up. "Officer Carter?" I sighed, pinching the bridge of my nose. "Officer Carter. You know the supervising customs officer? He was here yesterday." The man shook his head slowly. "I'm sorry, sir, but I've never heard of an Officer Carter. Would you like me to get the station chief instead?" My eyes closed and I shook my head, not even bothering to respond or hide my irritation. Without another word, I turned and walked away when I saw Harlan striding down the hallway, escorted by airport security on either side of him. I approached Harlan as the airport security officers stepped away. His face remained as impassive as ever, those unblinking eyes fixed on me. "Well, Mr. Duval, it seems today's your lucky day," I said, forcing a smile. "The United States government has decided to allow you to return to France." Harlan's expression didn't change. I continued, "Now, I should warn you. you'll likely face the same issues there as you've had here. But between you and me, I leaned in, lowering my voice to a conspiratorial whisper, that won't be our problem anymore. I pulled his passport from my jacket pocket and held it out. Harlan stared at it for a long moment, as if it were some foreign object, but he eventually took it. Come on, I said, gesturing towards the main terminal. We walked side by side through the bustling airport, the morning crowd surging around us. You'll be on another Air France flight, I explained as we navigated the corridors. 315 direct to Paris. Harlan remained silent, his gaze fixed straight ahead. As we walked through the terminal, my eyes caught on an American Airlines logo adorning a nearby gate. I blinked, certain my eyes were playing tricks on me. The familiar eagle was gone, replaced by a stylized A that seemed to morph into wings. The colors were all wrong, too. Instead of the classic red, white, and blue, it was a deep burgundy and silver. I shook my head, trying to clear the image from my mind. Out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw the faintest hint of a smirk cross Harlan's face, but when I turned to look at him directly, his expression was as impassive as ever. As we approached Gate 39F, Harlan's boarding group was already lining up. Well, Mr. Duval, looks like you're just in time, I said, gesturing towards the boarding doors. For the first time since we'd left the security center, Harlan spoke. His voice was cool and measured, carrying that strange accent I still couldn't place. I must say, Agent Benning, I had expected better hospitality. I laughed and shrugged my shoulders. Well, maybe next time you visit, we'll have fixed those history books for you. Harlan's face remained impassive, not even a flicker of amusement crossing his features. For the first time since we'd met, Harlan blinked. But it wasn't a normal blink. His eyelids closed sideways, sliding across his eyeballs like shutters closing. It happened so quickly, I almost doubted what I'd seen. I stood silently, watching Harlan's back as he turned and joined the line of passengers boarding the flight. My eyes drifted up to the logo above the boarding doors, expecting to see the familiar winged seahorse emblem of Air France. I blinked hard. The seahorse was gone. It was replaced by an entirely different creature.
New York Center, Air France 315. We have chaos in the cabin. The passengers are panicking. I'm getting reports from my crew about some kind of violence. We need immediate assistance.
Air France 315, are you reporting a physical altercation?
Yes. Yes, we need medical on our arrival. I'm getting reports of casualties in the cabin.
315, repeat report.
Yeah, 315. My co-pilot is back there. He's claiming, he's saying there's a man with, He's saying there's a man with a lizard's head in the cabin.
Air France 315, I'm not hearing you correctly. Repeat report.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening back there. I don't know what's happening, but it's real to them. My co-pilot said there's a man with a lizard's head. He said he's killing people.
315, I need you to gain control of your cabin and secure the cockpit.
Holy fuck, someone's trying to get into the cockpit. There's someone entering.